This is Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse, and I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr-McAvoy. Today, we're going to be taking a closer look at what is emotional and mental healthiness. How do we know we're not the narcissist? Be sure to subscribe and leave a review, and as a listener-supported podcast, your contributions are always appreciated. One of the things is very hard for us to understand is what is mental health? What does it really mean to be an emotionally stable person? What kind of characteristics do healthy people have? We certainly can identify it in each other when we're unhealthy because we make it uncomfortable for those that we're around. But do we recognize when in ourselves, when we ourselves are not healthy? Do we recognize our rigid thinking in the degree that we are unkind, that we need to be in control, that we feel fear? Do we recognize the degree that we make other people uncomfortable? One of the common problems when I would see in the office, and I also see it here on Narc Talk, is a lot of us feel we're in a relationship with a toxic person. Do we also then see our own toxicity? Living with somebody who's toxic, we are likely to adopt some of the qualities that they may have, but we also ourselves got into the relationship for our own vulnerable reasons. Yes, I do believe that toxic people groom us and pull us into toxic relationships that we're not aware that we're being manipulated, but we were vulnerable to some of that. There was an hungriness in us as well that made us more susceptible. One of the things I have to own, I don't like owning it, was when I met my second husband, that I was grieving and I was in an emotional mess. I knew that I no longer could be practicing, which is why at the time I did not return to counseling, is because I was doing too much work of my own. I was very vulnerable and wanted the life that I had had back. And I was desperate for that. I was struggling to adjust to widowhood. I was struggling to adjust to singlehood. And that made me vulnerable. That made me an easy target. It made me more likely to say yes to things that I probably would normally, if I was today, would have said no to. So one of the things that's hard work for all of us who have survived narcissistic abuse is to pull the lens back and include ourselves in the frame of the picture and ask what might have been the pieces of ourselves that have made us particularly uniquely vulnerable to that person at that time. And hopefully that's still not present for you today, but that it was then. And that helps you then be able to grow and assess what it is that you need to address, what it is that you need to work on. And that's really been very insightful for me to realize the next time I'm in a major transition, I shouldn't immediately leap out and try to solve it with another relationship. Thank you so much for joining me here today. I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr-McAvoy. I'm a psychologist who has had over 20 years of counseling experience. So hi, Dawn. So good to see you today. I did see your question. I'm going to go back and answer it. But those who are joining me, please put them in the Q&A. When they say they'll change, should you go no contact for a while? I've been hanging out with them. Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, one of the things before I start answering questions, yes, I am a clinician. I do counseling, but this is not to substitute for counseling. My advice here is just simply advice. And so this is not to constitute counseling. This is just simply me talking in general about issues that you bring up because I don't know your specific situation. To know if someone changed, especially when it has to do with narcissistic abuse and has to do with a personality characteristics, is really tough. You know, think about it. When you're being threatened with a loss of something, you're going to do and say about anything you can in order to preserve what you have. You don't want to disrupt what you have. So it is easy for people to give lip service, but change is only seen over time. It takes a long time of consistency and constancy and with a right attitude. That's the other piece I think is very, very pivotal, is that there's a right attitude. You should see somebody who's humble, who is remorseful, who takes ownership and accountability for what they've done and the way they've damaged the relationship. If you see someone who's resentful, irritable, snapping at you for being upset, does not like your reaction, is putting pressure on you to be different, to let it go, I don't see that as authentic change. I don't. Yeah, Stuart, that's another question. Would you put it in the Q&A? Because I would love to talk about whether or not narcissists can change. I know that's a very prevalent thought here. I know why we're saying it. I also, as a clinician, as a psychologist, I have some thoughts about that. It takes a long period of time for change to occur, and they have to rebuild trust. They have to be repentant in the meaning that they have to regret and do actually be different to change. And you'll see it, and it's not over weeks. You got to see this over months. So do you go no contact while you wait for someone to change? That is one way. That's a strategy to do. You could do that. You know, go on with your life, focus on yourself, get space, heal, and then let them do what they do. And if they're really motivated, they'll do the hard work and stay present and not jump in another relationship. If you see that they don't do that, then you know that that comment of wasn't really authentically real. It was just they didn't want change. They didn't want you to change their life or upset their life. But I know there are times where people do stay in contact when they're not for sure if they're ready to leave, and the person says, I promise I'll be different. And then you wait and you see while you're in the relationship. I think that's really hard to do. Here's a strategy if you want to do that. What I recommend is in your head, think of about like 4 to 6 qualities or issues you want addressed. Tell them two. Tell them there are 4 others that you're not telling them, but only tell them 2. Hold back the other rest. Do not ever tell them. And then in your mind, set a date when you're going to revisit this issue and come back and to see whether or not things have gotten better. See whether or not only the 2 were addressed that you told them, because obviously they're going to work on those 2, but also see if they address additional issues. That tells you how motivated they are to really work on the relationship. Because anytime that you set a bar and say, these are the things I require for us to have a relationship, they're going to hit every one of them. But that's not really authentic, motivated, self-motivated change. That's only, again, I don't want the relationship. I don't want my life to be disrupted. That's all the motivation is. So I would hold back some of them as a way to kind of test to see is this authentic? How high the motivation is there? Are they taking their own accountability, doing the hard work of digging into themselves? If they do that, then you know you've got somebody who's authentic, really working on issues. Yeah, ultimatums rarely work, unfortunately. They just rarely do. Whenever you set a boundary, it shouldn't be an ultimatum like, I want you in the relationship, but you have to change for these reasons. We need to say these things like, this is my boundary, and if it's not here, I can't stay. That's a whole different type of mentality to say, I can't stay if these things aren't present, than to say, you do it or if. It doesn't mean all you get is you get compliance, but you don't get a heart change. You don't really get off. You don't get somebody who's all in and invested. Melissa says, I know I need to leave, but why is it so hard to leave? The reason it's really hard to leave is because you're confused. You're very confused about what's real. You're not even sure if you know the person you're in a relationship with. You don't even know if this is a good relationship and if you should stay. And then you don't really know how safe if you can leave safely and leave in the way that kind of holds on to your own integrity. It's called cognitive dissonance. It is the number one thing that victims of narcissistic abuse find the most agonizing about relationships is cognitive dissonance. It is where we can't make a decision. Now, we all experience cognitive dissonance for lots of reasons. One is what did you have for lunch? Did you want to find a salad or did you have a sandwich? That moment of like, what am I going to do? How many calories am I going to have? That moment of tension you feel, that's cognitive dissonance. But what happens in these types of relationships is the moment you discover that something's terribly wrong, whatever the discovery is, you experience this incredible angst. And you begin to question. And yeah, I saw your comment about how you have children involved. You're right. That just adds more complexity because this is the father of your kids. And you know that no matter, even if you leave them, they're always going to be in your life. And unfortunately, the abuse doesn't just stop when you exit the relationship. It continues on in the form of legal abuse. So I know it's not simply a matter of I just exit this relationship and then I'm going to, you know, not have any problems. It's not that simple. How do you resolve the cognitive dissonance? That is the big question. That is the big question. What I would recommend, and there is no current good treatment protocols, I want to tell you, but here's some thoughts that I have as a person who's gone through this and experienced my own intense cognitive dissonance of why I couldn't leave either for as long as I did, as long as I stayed. I would recommend that you write down what it is that's keeping you. Write down the bind. These are my choices, and these are the ramifications if I do each choice, and these are the things I'm scared of, And these are the things I'm not sure about. And these are the things I don't know how to face. If you can put it down on paper, it becomes more containable, becomes more literal. And then you can actually, some of it becomes more measurable, and that gives you greater control over it. Some of it you're going to have to wait and see if it resolves on its own. Like if this person says, I'm going to be different, I'm going to be different. You can only know that with time. Some of these things you have to wait for your own readiness. That was true for me. I may have known this guy isn't going to change. I may have known he's a serial cheater, but I wasn't ready to leave. So you have to get to your own place of readiness. And some of them are things that you have to wait to get solved. Like maybe you need to change your financial situation. Maybe you need to find housing. Maybe you need to see an attorney. Maybe you need to understand the law in your area. All these things you need. So if by seeing it on paper helps you also identify the steps that you need to take to try to break through the indecision. That's why it takes seven times to try to leave, is because there's so much of this indecisiveness. And by the way, here's the other part. Are you noticing you're in a mental fog that's harder to make good decisions? Are you feeling more confused? You finding yourself struggling to find words? You find yourself explaining something and it doesn't make sense? It's like a bunch of garbled words coming out of your mouth. That's real. That's real. And it's not because you're insecure, and it's not because you're scared. It's because you're actually seeing cognitive changes brought on by cognitive dissonance. It actually shows brain changes. They've seen it. They've seen it. So the chronic stress is doing damage, and you're seeing the outcome of that with your confusion. It actually causes what's called a decline in executive functioning. So again, writing it down helps a whole lot. It will help you. Having a safe place to talk about it, being here and sharing it with us here, all these things can really, really help. And my heart goes out to you. I'm working on a cognitive dissonant course. I'm planning to launch it this late summer, and it will be about helping you with these issues, including some of these things that I'm talking about. If you're interested, please be sure to follow me so that you don't miss out when I'm launching the course. Why do some men, both men and women do this, jump into the next relationship so fast? That's been some interesting research on this. Men and women need kind of different things emotionally. So I want to talk about it from the standpoint of why do narcissists jump into the next relationship so fast? And then I want to talk about it from a gender standpoint, because there's really potentially two questions embedded in that question. Why do narcissists jump into the next relationship so fast? Well, one of the reasons is because they are constantly, let's back to the, I did a video yesterday that did very well, and I know it got a lot of pushback. People didn't like it, where I said narcissists don't enjoy being bored or downtime. Well, when you're not having a really rich interior life, when you're not a well-developed self, and these are underdeveloped, immature personalities, which is why they act out, because they don't have better resources to deal with their tough emotions and their tough experiences. And so they act out instead of addressing it, processing it. So when they don't have these sophisticated, more grown-up resources, as a result, they use all these external things to fix things for them. And one of the things they use is relationships. It helps them keep from being alone. It helps them feel like they're all that. It keeps shame at bay. It keeps boredom away. And it reaffirms that somebody's admiring them and giving them all attention. I know we call it supply, but yes, they're getting all of the supply that they need. That's why they jump so fast. Often, they're already lining up the next person before they do the discard. Already that person's been identified. They're already probably developing a relationship with this person. So then when they discard, they just go from point A to point B. But it's not because they've met someone better, and it's not because they're healthier or going to be happier. I know that's what they want us to think, but that's not it. It's because they can't deal with being by themselves. That's really the bottom line. And as a result of that, they leap. Now, let's look at it from a gender standpoint. Men and women look for different things emotionally from a relationship. You know, women provide a lot of stability for men. There's been some interesting study that found that single men do not live as long or as healthy as married men. So there's kind of like a civilizing or some kind of a something that marriages or relationships provide for men. Certainly it provides that their food and their laundry is done and things are kept up around the house and they're probably structured. But It provides probably some emotional support that they have a harder time finding from them for themselves. So men do better in relationship than women. Now, interestingly enough, women, married women do not fare as well as single women. Single women live longer than married women. So marriage or a relationship for women has a lot of costs for us. There's a lot more that we put out or sacrifice or lose of ourselves. So I think that's one reason why men jump so fast, is because why would you not get into something that's very beneficial for you? You know, that you're going to do well, survive better if you have. I got distracted because Louise is talking about my book. Yes, I wrote a book. I'm a writer, content creator full time now. And I wrote a book called Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross. It is an intimate up close look at what I went through between the period and when I lost my late husband to cancer, and then I ended up in this very devastating, tragic relationship with a narcissistic sociopath. 3 years of hell. Well, the first year I didn't know. Then the 2 years, right, I found out 2 months into the marriage that he's a serial cheater. I just learned that he was cheating the entire time. He passed 2 polygraphs saying that he didn't. He passed them. Isn't that amazing? So he was able to lie. So, yeah, it's horrific. So if you want to look at what happens, it can even happen to a psychologist. You know, Love You More is the name of the book. Thank you so much for the support of that. So let me jump back into the questions. What if I always apologize? Is it me? Apologizing is happens on 2 levels. One time, yes, I do see narcissistic people apologize a lot. Part of it is their way of, they're trying to run ahead of their, of you being critical of them. So they'll say things like, they'll end a phrase like, do you understand? Or is that right? Usually when you see that, you're seeing somebody who's grown up in a home where there's a lot of criticism. And there's been a lot of gaslighting, a lot of abuse, and this person's trying to keep the peace and keep conflict low. So you're going to see more of that with that. But both narcissists and non-narcissists do it. It's not specific to narcissists at all. It's just, that's really more of a sign that you've grown up in a home where there's communication has been wrought with landmines, really. So I would see that as, you know, it's kind of like a way to sort of ease or smooth, or using it like a conversation smoother. Yeah, I think, Tracy, you're talking about BIF, brief, informative, factual, and friendly communications. It's by Bill Eddies. That's a really good book if you want to know how to communicate with somebody who's highly conflictual, especially with emails or text messages, any kind of messaging. Like if you're trying to negotiate custody stuff between back and forth another parent, BIFF, B-I-F-F is the name of the book. It stands for Brief, Informative, Factual, and Friendly Communications. Bill Eddy is the name of the author. I highly recommend it. It's a very, very good book. Why do women cheat? It is amazing to me the number of women and men who cheat, a high rate of both men and women cheat in relationships. I think we do it for very, very different reasons. I think men often do it because they're getting more attention from someone else. They feel like life is kind of beating them down and they're looking for validation and respect. I think women are looking for another emotional outlet. Maybe they feel lonely. They don't feel like maybe the love between the relationship has gone flat. I know that there was strong disagreement to my video on whether or not all narcissists cheat. Listen. If that was a criteria, if we could know if you are a narcissist because you're cheating, wouldn't the APA add that in the DSM-5? Right? We put what we know to be valid criteria as ways to define people. So if cheating was such a great way to identify narcissists, and all narcissists do it, then why is it not one of the 9 criteria? Oh, I'd be happy to tell you what. So now some of you, I'll jump to a definition of narcissist. Some of you want to then leap to say, well, but they don't authentically are vulnerable and intimate in the relationship. And that's emotional cheating. Yeah, a lot of us do that. Probably a lot of you are doing that. And you're not a narcissist. Are you overtelling things to a friend? Are you choosing activities with your kids instead of your partner? How important is work to you? We're all guilty at some level of not fully being present in any given relationship because we're selfish. We're all at some level emotionally cheating. I bet all of you are a little guilty of it sometimes, right? So to say that that's a hallmark of just narcissists is to miss the bigger picture, that how many of us really, really show up in a relationship and really sacrifice who we are for the benefit of the sake of the relationship. Not a lot of us, and not very well. So back to, do all narcissists cheat? Yes, I know there are subtypes that do. You get into a relationship with a sexual narcissist, yes, they're going to be cheaters. Absolutely. But I'm going to tell you, the hero communal type is not cheating. They're the do-gooders. They're the ones who are on your school board. They're also manning on the boards of your all sorts of places. They're doing fantastic stuff for you. How do you know that they're narcissists? Well, you get to know them and they realize that why they're doing it is so that they look good. They're not doing it because they care about the children or sick people. They're doing it because they want to look good. Now, does it look good for them to be cheating? No. No, it doesn't. And they have an image to maintain, so they're probably not cheating. Now, I'm not saying every single one of them is not a cheater. I'm saying a lot of them are not a cheater. I've known personal people in my life who are narcissists who have never cheated. Not ever. Wouldn't even dream of it. Wouldn't even cross their mind. See, here's the dangerous part of saying this stereotype. If you're in a relationship with a narcissist who's not cheating, and then we say all narcissists cheating, then that person may say, well, then my person must not be a narcissist because they're not cheating. Well, no, they can be a narcissist and not be cheating. But then we also may have someone who's cheating, and just because they've cheated, we may say then they're a narcissist. Well, maybe they're not. Maybe there are other issues going on. Maybe, I don't know, but cheating happens for lots and lots of complicated reasons. And so that's what makes me uncomfortable with stereotypes. Yeah, so I'm very uncomfortable. Well, watch for your language with all or nothing thinking. Watch for this really, this black and white, this extreme. It's not, things are more complex, they're more gray. I wish the world was that simple. It isn't that simple. So, yeah. How do you help a friend get over a narcissist? Really, the question you're actually asking is, how do you help a friend break a trauma bond? Tough one. That's a tough one. There's a part of a grief that happens when after you've been in a relationship and you realize that you've made a terrible mistake and it has cost you something horrific. And you still are in love with the person, and you still wish, you believe the fantasy that you met is still true. You're not completely convinced that you never really met anybody that you knew. It's hard. There's a lot of things you have to sort of relinquish. That's part of the process. So what I would recommend as a friend to her is that you just provide space for her. And then when you hear her telling a mistruth or a misperception, you'll say, are you sure? Because that's not how it felt to me. That's what I would do. I would question her gently. Because from the outside, this is how it looked. I wouldn't come in and just tell them, but I would gently challenge their assumptions about things. And then just give time and space. It's a process to heal. It's like breaking a connection with literally a drug, you know, unfortunately, it is a lot like breaking an addiction. And she has to do the work. I guess that's the other piece, is you can't do the work for them. They have to do it for themselves. And there may become a point where you get to the place where you say, you know, is it helpful for me? I do think there's a place where if it goes on and this person keeps doing it, stay there for a long time, like years, talking years, you may have to assess how healthy is this for you if they can't move on. Because some people do. They get stuck there and they never move on. And then there are others that's just a phase. And it does take longer than we like. It is a very, very long phase. I do agree with that. I'm glad you guys like my necklace. It came as part of I bought it with another dress. And it came with a dress. So I got a 2-for-1. How do you handle a manipulative mother-in-law? Ouch. That's a typical situation. Okay. I have kind of some hard advice for you on this one. The hard advice is that you can't handle them. You have to have your partner handle them. It's your partner's mother. So my question to you is, does your partner agree that your mother-in-law is being intrusive and a problem? Because really, that's the person who needs to be setting limits with them. Now, I'm not saying you can't say, hey, I'm not going to be around, or I'm not going to go meet with her or take phone calls from her. You can do that. But when it comes to the family dynamics, like, would you go to holidays with them? How do you handle gift exchange? What do you do about the grandkids or any of those types of issues? Their parent needs to do the work of that. So that's the really hard part. The really hard part. You may find that you have a partner who can't take a stand, who will choose his family over you. And then your problem is with your partner for not having a stronger alliance with you versus with their family. And that may be something I would go to therapy about, honestly. Why did my ex blame me for cheating? Let me make sure I understand the story correct. Your ex cheated, and then he said, or she said, it's your fault because they cheated. The reason your ex is blaming you for the cheating is because that offloads the accountability and responsibility from them to you. It also then is a way for them to distract, make you the issue instead of them being the issue. It's just a highly sophisticated way of not taking responsibility, which is immature people are very, very good at that. Toxic people are very good at that. They don't want to take a long, hard look at themselves. So the way that they look at it is they make the issue you instead of making the issue with themselves. It's called externalization. So all of us have a tendency to how we deal with problems. When something comes up that's wrong, do you look to have something change in the environment, or do you look for you to do something different? Like, let's take, you got to get ready for a test. Are you hoping you ask all the teachers to find out what the questions are and hope she asks the right questions? Do you counting on a friend to give you notes, or are you studying and getting a good night's rest and making sure you go in to school or work or whatever it is that where the test is hydrated and ready to take the test? So there's, when we deal with it with ourselves, that's called internalization. And when we look to the environment to fix things, that's called externalization. Immature people do a lot of externalization. They look for relationships. They look for things around them to solve the problem. Well, if they have a problem with themselves, they're going to make it you as a way to solve the problem. Yeah, but the bigger question is, are you taking it? How are you handling the blame? You know, I would not. I would come back to, no, it's not me. I'm sorry. That's your interpretation of things. I don't agree. That's what I would do. I just say, well, that's your interpretation, and then drop it. You'll never argue them out of it, by the way, but you can hold your ground. You can certainly take a stance and hold your ground on it. You know a narcissist who's in an active addiction and not sober. Yeah, that's often common. There's a whole host of disorders that tend to occur with narcissistic personality disorder. They are things like, and by the way, I am not saying these things mean that these people have narcissism. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying narcissists are more commonly struggling with these things too, but other people struggle with them as well. And they include ADHD, addictions, self-employment problems. There's a whole host of things. Depression, anxiety. Now, like I said, other people also struggle with those things too. And just because someone's struggling with them doesn't make them a narcissist. But it's not uncommon, because back to that, what I was saying earlier about how they have a underdeveloped self. So when you sit by yourself completely alone and there's no distraction, are you able to sort of be with yourself? The more immature you are, the harder that is, because there's not the resources and a way for you to reflect with yourself. You don't have a lot of self-reflection. And also, you're more empty. It's not as developed. It's not as like, imagine a child's play versus how adult would approach a child's artwork versus an adult artwork. There's just kind of growth. You know, you see more resources as an adult has learned more and filled in more, and their talent then fills in more. The same kind of example happens with our sense of self. When you're more immature, there's less inside, less resources. And so as a result, they do a lot of efforts to distract, and addictions is a great way to distract. You can't feel uncomfortable if you're inebriated, sadly. Can women be narcissists? Absolutely. Absolutely. I've known several of them. It's the rate. The rates are somewhere between 2 to 1 to 3 to 1 are men to women. I think that's for lots of complicated reasons. I think part of it is our societal, the way we raise kids. I think maybe some of it's genetic. I think maybe some of it's due to the brain. I think it's for a variety of reasons, but certainly women are narcissists. This is not a male-only problem. Definitely not. I've personally known female narcissists, absolutely. And they can be just as toxic as men, for sure. Can I talk about how to deal with a do-gooder? You know, do-gooders are really all about image. And they it's really important for them to be seen as good, which is why all the focus on the image. But you know, also there's a somatic narcissist will do the same thing. They're all about image, but how they look on the outside or how they present. So do-gooders are concerned about how they present to the world and making sure they look good. Whereas in somatic narcissists are very concerned about how they present physically to the world. So there'll be excessive focus on the self. But it's both of them is very much a management of ego. And why? Because they want the attention. They want all the affirmation. So the question I have for you is, what is it happening with you in the relationship with a do-gooder that's making it problematic? Because one of the things, if it's a problem, you may want to then limit your contact, because that's where you have control. You don't have any control over what they focus on, but you do have control over how much focus you give them, how much you're in their life. So for me, otherwise I tend to ignore them. That's how I deal with them. I just don't focus on them. I don't give them what they want is really what I'm saying. I just don't give them what they want. How long should you wait before you date after a narcissist? Can you hear the heavy sigh? Longer probably than you want. There you go. I did try to date right after I exited mine. I was too triggered. I wasn't picking any healthier people. It has to get to a point where you feel like you're strong enough to have confidence in yourself. I think that's the key. Because what happens when you're in these relationships is they really tear our self-confidence apart. And then on top of it, we have all these cognitive changes where you don't really feel on top of it. And we begin to get scared. So if you're going out and meeting people and you're in a position of anxiety and you're fearing loss of control, then you're not ready. So I would look for where you feel like you feel enough confidence with yourself that you can trust yourself to be able to see the red flags and to be okay with whatever happens. And until you get that, how long will it take? I don't know. It's going to be different for each one of us. But those are the things I would watch for. How do you deal with a narcissist flirty husband? I'm assuming that you've told your husband that the flirting feels inappropriate. Do you know whether or not your partner has been a cheater? It sounds like there's two reasons why the flirting may be going on. One is because this person's grooming other people and trying to target somebody. Three reasons. I think I thought of a third reason. It could be this is a way they get supply, is they really like to go out and get attention. Yeah. So I would suspect it's the first. He's grooming. This is a way he's testing to see whether or not this person's potentially open to contact with him. The third reason is he knows it hurts you. Yeah, there often is a sadistic piece to this, which is they do it on purpose in order degrade you, to hurt you. They want you to know that you're not all that. So it does both things at the same time. It gets a person to see if they're going to receive their flirtation, at the same time showing you that you are not all that special in a way to deflate you. That's the word I was looking for. It's a way to deflate you. It's cruel. I'm really sorry. What is a narcissist? A narcissist personality disorder is one of, I don't know how many personality disorders there are in the DSM-5. I'm thinking something like 7 to 9. I don't know. It's quite a few, actually. And it's in what's called the Cluster B group. And the Cluster B includes borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and hysterical personality disorder. Why are they called Cluster B? Because there's not Cluster A, they're Cluster B. But what's similar about all of those groups is they're antagonistic. They're not agreeable people, they're antagonistic. They cause a lot of problems for people who are in a relationship with them. In order to be diagnosed as a narcissist, you have to be over the age of 18 and you have to have 5 out of 9 criteria. They're easy to find. If you go out to the DSM-5 and put in Google, DSM-5 and narcissistic personality disorder, you'll get all 9 categories. I can't list them all. I can tell you the bulk of them, but I can't list them all. They include this person is arrogant. They think they're entitled. They expect special rules. They are prone to envy. They also often are exploitive in relationships. They lack empathy. And I can't think of the other ones off the top of my head. You have to have five of these criteria to qualify, and you have to be diagnosed by a mental health professional, which means by a licensed psychologist or a licensed psychiatrist or a physician. Most people who do the diagnoses are psychologists like myself or psychiatrists. So yes, I have diagnosed people with NPD. I am able to do that. I can't do it over the internet. I have to meet the person in order to be able to know if they qualify. Now, a lot of us talk about narcissistic abuse. Our partners or the people in our lives or family members have not been technically diagnosed. Is it legit to talk about this? Absolutely. Because this is what I think. I think there's a difference between narcissistic abuse and narcissists. We're all on the spectrum. We all are capable of being narcissistically abusive to each other, even if we're not a narcissist. I think it's totally legit to talk about this. And I also think that other cluster B personality types or tendencies and traits also do narcissistically abuse. Meaning you can be more of a hysterical person or a antisocial personality disorder, a sociopath, and still narcissistically abuse those in your life. You can be a borderline and still narcissistically abuse those in your life. Why do we use that word? I think it's just a catch-all phrase to talk about a relationship style of abuse. It's just what caught on and has become terminology. It's a way that we capture this whole area, this whole topic of dysfunctional relationships. So I hope that helps you with what is it? It's, if I was to say from theoretical, how would I define it? It's a person who has a wound or damage to the self, or an immature and underdeveloped self that feels an insatiable hunger and need for connection and admiration and approval. I think a lot of them are shame-based, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them are shame-based, and they have this insatiable need to have this fixed, and they use people, relationships to do it, and they see people as objects to which to satisfy this insatiable need. That's how I would define narcissism, is that. It's not self-love. They're not in love with themselves. They actually really don't like themselves. But they cover it up with this grandiosity and excessiveness and exaggeration, or with an excessive focus on failure. That brings me into the other question that somebody's been asking. What is a covert narcissist? So I'm going to leap into that. There's two presentations of narcissism, an overt narcissism and covert narcissism. By the way, you're going to hear a whole lot of people defining this very differently from person to person. And that, why is that? That's because our field is in transition in its definition. Sam Vanknin on YouTube this week put up, or maybe it was last week, put up a discussion of this, about how we're in this massive transition of redefining terminologies and trying to understand this better. And as a result, every person's going to say a little bit different thing, because it's just, we haven't decided it. It's not fixed yet. But the way I'm understanding it, and it's different from the way I used to understand it, so I'm struggling. I may not explain it very well. But overt narcissists are, all the subtypes have both an overt and a covert presentation. So if you are a grandiose narcissist, you have an overt presentation, and then there's a covert presentation. An overt presentation is the confident, oversell, the braggart, the grandiosity. The covert is the failed overt narcissist. They're the deflated victim. Nothing ever goes right, but it's always all about them, and they're very passive aggressive. Same goes with a sexual narcissist. There's an overt presentation and then a covert presentation. Covert is the reverse inverse of an overt. It is the failed version of the overt. So if you wish to be all that and you are a failure and it never happens for you, you're going to then implode, and you're going to be then, woe is me. It never goes right. I'm always the problem. I'm always the victim. That's what happens. It's the inverse. It's the implosion versus the explosion. That's the best way I understand it right now. I really want to do more deep dive into it to get it, but I'm trying to explain to you how I'm kind of hearing it. Yeah, covert is hard. I agree. Covert is hard to recognize because they don't present. They're not easy to spot. And they appear because they're so preoccupied with themselves and what went wrong. You think you're seeing somebody who's empathic, and they're not. They're very self-centered, but it's always about them. So you think, oh, wow, look, they're so reflective and they're talking about what we're wrong. And they'll be reflective and care about me. Mm-mm. No, there is no you. It's always all them. It's always all them. I met somebody and I had a conversation with this person on the phone. I listened to this person over an hour of all that was going wrong with this person over an hour. And finally, this person kind of tossed the conversation ball back to me and say, so how's it going for you? I started describing a bit. This person used one. I only got a couple sentences out. One or two of my sentences used it to jump back to themselves and took the conversation back over for another 45 minutes. Why did I sit on it so long? Yeah, I need to ask myself that question. But it was, they only existed. It was all that was going wrong. They one-upped me on everything. They had it worse. They life was harder for them. You know, if I talked about how I've been, they had a worse bad day than me. They seem to be empathic, but they're not. They're the failed narcissist. That's a covert narcissist. I also see people who are both, that present both, honestly, and they may fluctuate. You know, the narcissist I was married to at times would, the person I was married to at times would be overt, very grandiose, and then things would happen, something would happen, then he would fall back into a depressed position, and then woe is me, woe is me. But so I kind of saw this mixed picture. You may too. Do I tell my husband I think he's a narcissist? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Why not? Well, for one, they won't agree. They will just smear you, just degrade you, put you down for that. They'll just use it as another way to abuse you. So why give them that asset, that resource? Then you're also, by the way, by you doing that, you're telling, it's like giving, let me back up. Narcissists tend to see the world as a competitive. They're often competing with you and they don't see you as a safe person. And they're not part of a team with you. When you tell somebody that, you're assuming we're in this together and we're working on it, but that's not how they see the world. They see the world as them against the world, and you are a part of the world. So them against you. I know that you have a relationship, and I know you may have kids together, but that's not how they see the world. So you giving them this information, they're going then to gear up and weaponize and get ready to deal with you around it and strike you around it. Yeah, so no, it does not benefit you. In the least, it will only harm you. I would use the information for you to get ready. Get ready for, you know, whatever, learn about it. Learn how to protect yourself. Learn how all the techniques to keep yourself emotionally safe. That's what I would do. But you gain nothing from telling them. Nothing at all. My ex used to ask me, do you think I'm a narcissist? I never really came out and said, I would say, well, the world's certainly according to you. And he'd laugh and goes, yes, isn't it? That's what he would do. My was not wanting to pay child support. And he now wants them Monday through Friday. You know, that is such a typical way. I'm not an attorney. I really can't comment on the legal system, except to say that I know toxic people use it as a way to abuse us. I know that. And they will do what, and they don't want to pay, you know, they don't have a sense of accountability for their kids either. So they would certainly weaponize that. And they certainly don't come through for that. So it's very, very hard to have that kind of situation where they show up and really be present. And you're right. It's probably for all the wrong reasons. They're not wanting to be with the kids Monday through Friday because they want to see more of them. They want to pay less. That's what this is about. And it's heartbreaking. It's super heartbreaking. Exactly. It's all about him. And I know you know that, which breaks your heart and makes you angry too. What causes cognitive dissonance again? Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to explain it. That is something that's happening to us constantly about everything. Even if you think about what your plans are for tonight, if you have a choice, if there's a choice involved, you will have some cognitive dissonance. That moment when you feel the tension of trying to make a decision, that's what cognitive dissonance is. So say, for example, you're at the store and you see two really good blouses. You only have enough money for one. You have cognitive dissonance as you decide which one you're going to pick. It gets resolved with the decision. So as you face a decision, you feel the stress. It's stress. And the minute you make the decision, the stress goes away. The problem with narcissistic abusive relationship is it's filled with stress and tension. And there's all sorts of questions that never get answered. Even gaslighting causes cognitive dissonance. That person just right now, that presentation of the problem of my partner doesn't want to pay child support, but they want the kids to know Monday through Friday. That was a perfect example of cognitive dissonance. You're saying to yourself, what's real? Why do they really want them? Is that really a good thing? What should I do about that? All of that is stress. All that stress is cognitive dissonance. And it's painful. We want a decision. We want to have a solution. The painfulness causes damage. Living in that constant lack of resolution does damage to your brain. But we live in it where our relationships are permeated in it. These relationships are so toxic. It's just riddled with it. This person isn't being real. They're not being honest. They're being deceptive. They're then turn around and they abuse you. You don't know what's real, what's true, what's not true. You don't, everything. It's all creating tension and stress and and lack of knowing, lack of closure and certainty. That's cognitive dissonance. There is a good book that kind of talks about it from a big kind of relational standpoint that I highly recommend. In fact, I'm interviewing her August 18th. Her name is Krista Milstead. She wrote the book called, I'm trying to reach it right now, called Why Can't I Just Leave? So Dr. Milstead also got into a narcissistic abusive relationship. She is a psychologist like myself, fell into this like I did. And then her book, instead of my book's all about what happened, tells you the story of it. Her book tells you why you get caught with cognitive dissonance, called Why Can't I Just Leave? Why Can't I Just Leave? The whole book describes, she tells her story a little bit and then begins to give you descriptions of how it shows up, the cognitive dissonance, and why we get so immersed and embroiled and we can't make decisions. So if you want to be able to kind of understand that better, that's a really great book. My online course will be help you kind of take you through it very slowly and with some exercises, and that will be ready late summer. If you were a narcissist, would you be able to know that you are? Sometimes, maybe, not always, probably most of the time, no. It takes a lot of self-reflection. Some have some self-reflection. See, nothing is never. That's why I don't say narcissists could never change. It's not ever a never. It's most of the time, the most of them don't, is really maybe a more fair way to say it. But just like their ability to be self-reflective. Some of them have almost no ability to be self-reflective. Others have less ability. Imagine most of your skills, your big girl, big boy skills, you know, resist impulses, handle difficult emotions, plan, set plans, take initiative, show judgment, reflect on yourself. Look at all these skills, okay? That's what's called ego strengths, your ego strengths. And every single one of them, view them as a rank order from 0 to 100%. From non-existent to incredible, okay? By the way, nobody's at a 0 and nobody's at 100. Empathy is another one, by the way. You all are somewhere on that slide from 0 to 100. You're somewhere. Narcissists are somewhere on that slide. Now, granted, they're on the low side of it. And hopefully you're on the higher side of it. But every single one of these, they have strengths and weaknesses. And we view them as like sliding scales. I don't know if you guys ever saw Westworld, the science fiction on HBO. They talk about robots. And the robots, they have this grid. This person has IQ. They have the ability to be charming. And they have the ability to be insightful. And they literally look up and down these grids like, oh, I'll give her a lot of IQ. But I won't make them very charming. You know what I'm saying? That's it. That's actually... That's how our ego strengths look. They're like all these characteristics, and we all rank order how strong and how weak we are on each one of them. Narcissists would have a lot of confidence. They'd be very charming. They may have an IQ, maybe not. They all vary. They would vary the same degree you and I would vary on that. That's not necessarily a strength or a weakness of them. But when it comes to self-reflection and empathy, they're going to be low. They're not going to be high, but they're not zero. They're not zero, but they're going to be low. Now, you may meet people who are higher. Maybe they're closer to normal, but still weak. Some of these things, by the way, can be grown. They're muscles. Just like you would get stronger with lifting things, you can get stronger at self-reflection. It is possible to gain more impulse control. learn to show judgment and have critical thinking. All of that's possible. So with practice, you can get better at this. That's why I'm saying narcissists can change with practice. Now, are they motivated? Well, when you're really trying to avoid intense shame and pain, and you don't like looking at yourself because you don't really like who you are, it's hard to change that. It's hard to do anything different because you can't slow down and look at it. So that's why a lot of us say, don't look for change. Don't act like change is going to happen. You need to take care of yourself. Can they both be narcissists and sociopaths at the same time? Absolutely. Yeah, those cluster B, all personality disorders as well as mental health disorders can co-occur, meaning they can happen at the same time. So you can have someone with narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. Yes, absolutely. You can also have someone who's a narcissistic personality disorder with traits of an antisocial personality disorder, meaning they have many of them, but not all of them. And you can have someone who's an antisocial personality disorder with traits of a narcissistic personality disorder. Again, means they have some of them, but not all of them. So yes, they're very, very possible. What we generally call that subtype is a malignant narcissist, or what I would do is refer them to as a narcissistic sociopath. That's who I married, by the way. I married a narcissistic sociopath. Very toxic person. One of the more dangerous ones, actually, because they're conniving and ruthless. Yeah, and then they have enough courage and chutzpah to pull it off. Is it normal for a narcissist to constantly blame you? Yeah, if you are shame-based core, if you really don't like yourself and you're looking for a patsy, for someone to offload all the uncomfortable things in your life, everything that you can't face about yourself, it's very easy to make it about somebody else. Part of what happens is narcissists go into a relationship with this fantasy. You know, if you have a hole, if you're like really like innately, unconsciously hungry for something, like you feel like you really want someone to see you as special, you'll go into this relationship thinking, oh, I met somebody who thinks I'm walk on water and she will fix or he will fix everything for me. And then I won't feel like this anymore. Well, part of the problem is they have what's called low receptive capacity, meaning whatever you give them, it runs through them. They're like a sieve. They don't hold on to these things. So you may pour all the love in the world to this person, but they like it just drains out. There's nothing inside to hold on to it very well, so it doesn't feel loving, even though you're being loving. So they go into the relationship with this fantasy of thinking that this new person is somehow better than the last person and somehow going to fix everything. And the problem is you're just human. You're just like everybody else, and they're just like everybody else, and no relationship can fix all our problems. But in fact, they bring problems. And so when they start to realize you're not any different than the last person they're with, then they become disillusioned and they get ready to discard. But they blame you as a way to sort of like try to attempt to deal with this. And it's very easy for them just instead of like doing the harder work of saying, wow, I've been in 10 relationships and they've not gone well. What might that say about me? No, they just say, well, this one wasn't that and this one didn't do this. And if this one had been better at this, it's just that, and they don't see that that's even not working. It's just sad. The whole thing is very, very, it's heartbreaking. What type of attachment disorders do narcissists tend to have? And I know there's another question that I really want to get back to too. So John, I'm going to hold on your question and deal with a question that came in from Underground Roads. Do you ever ask myself if I was attracted to a narcissist or they look for people to prey on? I think it's both. I think that's a both question. I think some of us are used to toxic behavior for lots of complicated reasons. It's familiar. It gives us a charge. There's a level of excitement to it. We don't realize the excitement is fear-based, not really out of safety. And we just get accustomed to it. We've been in hot water before and we look for hot water again, so to speak. You know, the frog in a hot water, you know, you've used to it, you just look for it again. But I also know that narcissists, it came out of Sandra Brown's work at Purdue University, showed that the number one quality that narcissists are looking for is agreeableness and conscientiousness. And those qualities make somebody loyal, cooperative, empathic, they're a good team member, and they believe in the goodness of other people. That makes you pretty easy to be with. If you're a toxic person, why would you not want to find someone who's easy to be with? Those qualities make people easy to be with. So yeah, that I do think that they're looking for a specific type that's going to cause less problems for them, that are going to be good matches, and that personality style is a good match. So That's one reason. So I think it's a both end problem. What type of attachment styles are narcissists? I think they can be all of them, to be honest with you. I don't think they're very secure. I wouldn't expect secure one to be present, but I wouldn't be surprised to find some that are avoidant. I think a lot of them would be avoidant or disorganized, but I also think they can be possibly anxious. You know, you will see some of the narcissists who are very clutchy. You know, they don't like to be separated. They don't want to have their partner absent from them. They always need to be with somebody. So that's kind of a more anxious style. But I also know plenty who want a relationship, but more mind only, more an idea only, and they push the partner away. And yes, you're going to see a lot of problems with trust, which is more of a characteristic of a disorganized or anxious avoidant attachment. So I think all three of them potentially just not healthy. So what kind of books do I recommend for dealing with narcissists? I actually have a resource list. If you go to the link in my bio, it actually takes you to my website. It takes you to my website, and one of the links at the top, and I just made it easier to see, takes you to a site where I break it out for links for narcissists, books for narcissists, books for parents, people who are dealing with parents who are narcissists, books also for partners. And then also just some mental health books and some other resources too. So if you're looking for things that are my favorite books, you can find it in the link in my bio. Can I give information on narcissist and borderline personality disorder? Yeah, you know, borderline personality disorder. So they're both developmental phases, by the way. And that's why we're all on the spectrum. We all have these issues because we all go through these phases, because that's part of being human. You know, when we're first born, we don't really know that we're a separate person. As you begin to realize that you are a separate individual, you begin to realize people can leave, but they also can overwhelm you. And then when they overwhelm you and control you, you're not really fully yourself. You feel sort of engulfed or suffocated, swallowed up. That's the twin fears of a borderline dynamic. They're afraid of engulfment and they're afraid of abandonment. They don't want you to walk away and be gone, but they don't want you to take over for them to cease to exist. And they're very sensitive to that. But there's also a lot of emotional dysregulation as part of that disorder. But at a core fear base, that's what they're afraid of. The next phase is narcissism, which is you need to know that you're special to somebody. You know, that your parents think that your poop doesn't stink and you're all that and you're wonderful, and how they count your fingers and, you know, ooh and ah over all your little mistakes and cheer you on for learning to walk. All those things that we need to know somebody sees us that way. But it's called being the apple of someone's eye. When we miss that, we hunger for that. We still have an insatiable need for that. And simultaneously, we need to know that we're understood, that when you skin your knee that it hurts and somebody sees that it hurts and validates that it hurts, that's called mirroring. So we both want to know that we're special and chosen, but we also need to know that somebody's attuned to us and sees us and meets our needs around that. So what goes wrong with narcissism, for whatever reason, we're not for sure why, that people walk away with either one of both of those issues. They either feel like they need this insatiable seen as special, or they have this great need to be understood and really look for excessive mirroring. And they use people as objects to do that. They don't see people as really people. They see them more like you'd see your car. It's functional. You don't really recognize the car has feelings. You don't worry about it and take care of it. You just see the car as useful to you. And when it ceases to have use to you, you get rid of it and get a new car, right? Well, that's what they do to relationships. That's how they're making it. They move through it. Yeah, I see the question about God and narcissism. I kind of try not to talk about religion and how it intersects here, because I just find this a very difficult way. But I do think faith is an interesting piece. I do think, you know, if there is an infinite universe creator, could he solve things? Sure, he could. But that's kind of outside the scope of this. We're talking about psychology and mental health. So, but I appreciate you bringing that up. There's two questions that came in, one's from Claudia, one's from Wildcard. They both have sort of the same feel. One is, I found out my mom's a narcissist. The other one is, my partner is legally abusing me. How do I stop it? They're really kind of the same dynamic, which is you're being affected by someone else's decisions. How do you contain it? The hard part of both of those questions is that there's aspects of it that you're not in control. You don't have any say-so over how the court system will or will not work in your best interest. So yes, a lot of them do legally abuse. That's true. I think this is something I'd be talking to my attorney about. How can you sort of control, reduce, sort of make that less so? I also would be creating a legal document, which is, every time that you have contact with this partner or person, have a written notebook of time, dates, what was said, and what was observed. Do not make any statements of what you conclude or assume. Only of time, what you observe, and what they say. Date it, stamp it, and sign it every single time. Every single time. You cannot make any assumptions. You cannot say they behaved narcissistic. No, you don't know that. You're not a psychologist. You can say this person said this. The children cried when this was said. That's all you can observe. It has to be what you observe. Strictly what you observe. It has to be a great red high heels is exactly right. It has to be observable, measurable. If you keep that, it shows a track record, a history, and you can even show escalation. You can say, look, they stopped by 5 times last week. This week it's 10 times. Last week they said these things. This week they screamed these things. You know, you can show escalation. That helps a lot. It helps a lot, but you can't actually stop all forms of legal abuse. That's something that you don't have control over. You don't really, because you don't have control over the judges and scheduling and attorneys and all of that kind of stuff and motions that can be filed. And when it comes to the family, it's sort of a similar position, but different. What's good about family is you can limit your contact. You can't change how a person in your house shows up or doesn't show up in the family, but you can show, you can decide how much you will, how much access you're going to give this person to you, how much, you know, how much contact you will have. You have control over that. So those are the things I would manage. You know, if this person's really toxic, I would see your family less. I'd be less opening for holidays. I would have an exit plan. I would, you know, everything that you can, everything you can. Thank you so much for hanging out with me today. This was amazing. Check out my book. I'd love you to have you do that. Also, thank you so much for following me here. I appreciate it. And yeah, you guys are amazing. I'm so thankful. So thank you so much. Bye-bye.